It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Well, hello again out there in Radio Land. I hope you're ready for another dose of wisdom. Today on Alaska Tracks, we'll be wrapping up our three-part series with Sam Harbo, who is a man of high intelligence and high integrity. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I have the privilege of serving as the host of this program. I began recording these interviews nearly 30 years ago. I hadn't listened to some of them in at least 15 to 20 years. This program has given me a reason to go back and hear them again. I find myself smiling at the great stories these folks share with us. That's especially true of today's guest. I'm referring to Sam Harbo. We heard from Sam the last two episodes, and today we'll wrap up the three-part series. In today's first segment, Sam shares experiences and insight from his own personal hunting career. Be prepared. These aren't your standard hook-and-bullet stories. Sam will make you think. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about some of your own personal hunting and fishing experiences here in the state. Have you, over the years, harvested moose and caribou for the table?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up on doing that. I grew up on what I consider to be a subsistence farm in southern Minnesota. And I'm a prisoner of my upbringing. Well, fortunately, in many respects, unfortunately in some. And the example I use is, well, there are two examples, sheep hunting and bear hunting. I've only gone sheep hunting really once. I went sheep hunting up in the Brooks Range with one of the fellow faculty members. And I got a nice ram, but it never was really very rewarding for me. And I really couldn't figure out why it wasn't. Until I was doing some caribou work. Can't remember where I was. But there were bears around, and I decided, I'm going to shoot a bear. And so I was sitting on a little rocky knoll, and there was a grizzly chasing a little band of caribou cows and calves. And it came right by me. And I got the gun up. No, I don't want to do this. So I started thinking about it. And I suddenly realized that I didn't really enjoy that sheep hunt much. I enjoyed the outing, but I just didn't enjoy the taking the animal. I could have been just completely happy without taking that animal. And here I was, perfect chance on a nice grizzly, and turned it down. And I suddenly realized that the only hunting that I really enjoy is when I can put the meat on the table. I realized I was a prisoner of my upbringing. That's the reason we went hunting and fishing in Minnesota when I was a kid on a small farm, was to put meat on the table. My hunting partner looked at that sheep strictly as a trophy, not as the meat. I looked at it strictly as the meat, not as the trophy, and I didn't enjoy it. That's why I realize we're in such difficulties now, because the kids that are growing up in an urban setting are going to be the prisoner of their same upbringing. I can't get rid of my difficulty. They're not going to get rid of theirs either. It's interesting. We've hunted a lot of different places. I think one of the favorite places was when Miller House was still in existence up the Stees. We would go up there and rent a cabin and then hunt the hills back of Miller House for caribou. That was always interesting, mainly because of the old time setting with the Millers still living there and renting out those cabins. So you still had that historical background. But also getting up in that alpine country, up in Eagle Summit and so forth, there's still some of the prettiest country around. It's not rugged like many of the other areas of Alaska, but it's almost top of the world as far as I'm concerned. It's really enjoyable. I think one of the most unique hunting experiences I've had for moose involved one morning walking down the railroad tracks at Ferry, again before school at the university. I walked a long way down. All of a sudden, there was a moose standing about 10 feet off the railroad track. So I shot it and got it and cut it up and put it in game bags and stacked it along the railroad track and flagged down the passenger train when it came from Anchorage. And engineer just backed the freight car right up next to where the moose was so we could just throw it in. And I walked back to the club car and had a beer and came back into Fairbanks. Another time I went before school, and this was early September, must have been about the 4th or 5th of September. Went out in back of Creamer's, but I came in from the Farmer's Loop side, where that old feed store used to be. I was going to go duck hunting. There was a cable across the road, so I couldn't get down there. So I decided, okay, I'll go down to some ponds I knew across from Sheep Creek. I was driving along, sun just enough to see, and I could see there were four moose down in there. So I stopped, got the glasses out, and one of them was a yearling bull. So I pulled off the road, got out, and shot the yearling bull, and drove the Land Rover down, backed up to it, and skinned it, and threw it in the back of the Land Rover and went back home and had the thing hung up by 6 o'clock that morning. And now it's just a series of houses in there. But that's how things have changed so dramatically around here. I used to feel that moose hunting around here was just a matter of putting in time. You'd go out one morning, you wouldn't get it. Go out next, you'd get it. It was just a matter of putting in time. And I can remember before Dick Bishop retired from Fish and Game, talking with him about that. And I said, that used to be my attitude, but it isn't anymore. I mean, you can't just expect to put in your time and necessarily get a moose. He said he used to feel the same way. It was just a matter of going out and putting in your time that you'd run into one. It certainly used to be that way. But now there's just so much traffic from ATVs that you can't outwalk them. And that's what I used to do. I like to go out and hunt where it's quiet. I don't like machinery that takes up space. So I've always walked wherever I possibly could. I've flown in on sheep hunts and I've flown in on moose hunts. But the ones I really enjoy are where I can get out and hike. I can remember talking with one of the Beifelts in Huslia. This was when I was out there doing mink research. I had come back in September. Coming back down the river, I stopped because a couple of guys set up a moose camp there. And I asked him if they got any moose, and he said, yeah. He said, my two boys are out getting it. He said, your two boys are out getting it. One of them was 10, the other was 12. I think that's what he said. He said, they wanted to go out hunting. And I said, now, when you go, you don't shoot anything more than just a few hundred feet from the river. And he said they were out hunting yesterday, and he said they didn't see anything along the river, so they started going back to this oxbow and then this little lake, and he said they saw a moose back there, and they shot it, and it was about a mile back. He said they're hauling every bit of it out.
Teach them a lesson, huh?
Yes. That's another thing that many people don't realize. They think that all Alaskans that hunt moose just strictly hunt because it's a sport. One of the interesting surveys that would be, I think, really revealing would be to question all Alaskan hunters who have ever shot a moose if they would shoot another moose if they couldn't have the meat themselves. They'd have to pack it out, but they couldn't have the meat themselves. And I suspect that there wouldn't be a single hunter that would go ahead and say he would still hunt moose. Because hunting moose is hard work once you get the animal. And that's another thing I think that most people don't understand about resident moose hunters. It's meat on the table. If they couldn't put that moose on the table. I really like a cured black bear ham. They're good. I have not been able to shoot one because still a bear is a trophy. I mean, that's why you shoot one. I can remember picking blueberries out Sheep Creek Road, and I had my gun with me because it was moose season, and there was a bear just the right size. I mean, it was probably a two-year-old. Would have been just delicious. And I got the gun sights on it, and I couldn't do it. Bear ham is really good, but it was still a trophy. Like I say, I'm a prisoner of my upbringing. If I go out hunting now, I essentially just want to go out hunting with my boys. And I don't take a gun. I just thoroughly enjoy being out. And I enjoy them getting something, and I'll help pack and so forth. But it's just being out in the country. One of the most enjoyable hunting experiences I had was flying into lake in the Nalchina Basin. Two boys and I flew in for them going moose hunting. And we camped right on the shore of the lake. And they were out hunting one day, and I had stayed in camp. While they were gone, caribou started coming, moving from the summer range to the winter range. And they'd come down and have to swim across the lake right next to the camp. Magnificent, great big antlers. Might be 20 or 30 caribou coming in and just single file swimming across. I could have watched that forever. Just a gorgeous sight. It's things like that that we enjoy going up to Eagle Summit when the flowers are in bloom. It doesn't have to be wildlife necessarily. Mm-hmm. It just has to be out. And there aren't very many places other than Alaska that afford that anymore. You can find it in places in the West, but
pretty profound stuff from a man who isn't afraid of a little self-judgment and self-analysis. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. A big thank you to those sponsors for keeping us on the air. Please patronize them when the time is right. Now back to our interview with Sam Harbo. In this next segment, Sam talks about his 10-year tenure on the Alaska Board of Game.
And in 1975, I was appointed to the Alaska Board of Game, and I served till 1985, essentially 10 years. The Board of Game was also a very interesting experience because it epitomized what you might call the subsistence battle in the state of Alaska. In 1975, we recognized subsistence as a critical use of fish and game resources in the state. We didn't really define subsistence, but I think each of us had an idea of what it was. It turned out that our ideas of what subsistence was and what we were implementing in our game management was very different than what subsistence was defined to be, and ultimately the courts decided it was to be based on ANILCA. In many instances, we had allocated resources that were designed primarily for local residents. We set beaver seasons that were designed essentially so that about the only people that would utilize it were locals. We did the same thing with moose seasons. However, that was not adequate as far as meeting the requirements of the subsistence provisions in ANILCA. And to this day, the state and the federal government have very different views as to what subsistence really is as far as the utilization of resources are concerned. It's an ongoing battle that I don't know how it will ever be resolved equitably or to the satisfaction of everyone. In its purest sense, I think everyone agrees that subsistence use should be a priority use. And in its purest sense, it means the utilization of resources for the very continued existence of individuals and for the existence of their particular lifestyle. There were efforts made to define subsistence to be utilization of resources where the overwhelming majority of a person's time was devoted to the collection, preparation, utilization, and storage of renewable resources such as fish, game, edible plants, wood, gardening, etc., where essentially what determined subsistence was the lifestyle, not anything else, not the cash basis, not the monetary requirements, not the location of the individual and so forth, but the very lifestyle. And that if a person did not have the ability to harvest wood, plants, fish, game, and so forth in its natural state, that their very lifestyle would be endangered. Unfortunately, those ideas found very short shrift in the political environment that had developed around the subsistence debate. And so we're still in a quagmire as to what subsistence really is. Those that truly do live a subsistence lifestyle know what it is. It's the rest of us that I think are very confused about it.
One thing we haven't touched on is enforcement personnel, game wardens and that sort of thing. Were there any issues there that you thought were important, or were there any of the people involved that you thought did an especially good job or maybe a bad job?
Well, for a while in the Department of Fish and Game, enforcement got a very short shrift because they were trying to increase hunting pressure rather than decrease hunting pressure. So violations were kind of winked at. It's not that case anymore. One of the interesting things about regulations is that almost always we set regulations now that are more restrictive. Very frequently do you set regulations to try and make it easier to take something. There are some exceptions, but by and large it just goes the other way. And it just is a reflection of the fact that we've got so many more people on very limited resources.
Before we got started, you told a story about Sidney Huntington and how he had convinced the locals that it was important to obey the harvest limits.
When I was doing mink research in 56-57 in Hooslea, Sidney Huntington was considered the beaver trapper. If anyone wanted to talk about beaver, they would say, go and talk with Sidney. was essentially the expert beaver trapper. And Sidney Huntington realized that you could easily trap out beaver huts if you didn't set the sets right as far as distance from the hut and so forth. But the Fish and Wildlife Service, apparently quite a few years before that, had been concerned about the pressures on some of the beaver populations, and so they had put a 25-foot restriction on trapping near to a beaver house. And apparently a lot of the locals had been trapping right up next to the beaver house. And Sidney realized that that was a very worthwhile regulation, and I think took it upon himself to try and convince his fellow trappers that they should obey that 25-foot restriction because it was to their benefit. But I was impressed then that he was really an observant individual and felt it was worth his while to go ahead and convince his fellow trappers of the virtue of this. And I think he got good compliance.
Now, did your tenure on the Board of Game overlap with Sidney?
Oh, yes. He was on there the full 10 years that I was on there. Yeah, he was a real pleasure to serve with. He would really speak his mind.
Did you get the hint how this man can see through all of the distractions directly to the heart of an issue? I admired him for that. Now let's give Sam a chance to summarize his life and career.
That's another thing I guess I'd ask you to reflect on. You've already told us you were in Hooslea and Nome and Cold Bay and Southeastern, the Brooks Range, so you've been all over the state. Do you like it all, or is there one place in particular that stands out as kind of your favorite?
It all has its attributes. The thing is, I think the interior of Alaska for the summers is unbeatable. I really enjoy the summers up here. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't trade it for Southeastern. I wouldn't trade it for Barrow. Wouldn't trade it for Nome. Wouldn't trade it for Cold Bay, but I'd like Cold Bay in October, November, and for waterfowl hunting. But I have been fortunate in seeing just about every part of Alaska. I've never gotten west of Adak, but...
Yeah, that's about as far as it goes.
It's been a very rewarding experience. Like I say, I'm so thankful for that cocktail party. The best cocktail party I've never been to.
When did you retire from your position at the university?
Let's see, when did I retire? It must have been in 1985 or 86. 20 years, good grief.
And yet you've maintained your interest and involvement, maybe not quite up front and on the headlines, but you've maintained your involvement with the wildlife through the Outdoor Council, I know, but in other ways, maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, professionally, I've been involved with wildlife all my life, and even before I was involved with it professionally, I earned shoe money and spending money and so forth with wildlife. So it's just been an interest all my life. I haven't remained very active in the last few years, but the thing is the interest is still there. And if certain issues come up that I feel are important, then I will get involved. One thing I have not kept up with are the statistical tools. My reason for getting the statistical tools was to handle wildlife analysis. And since I've gotten away from wildlife, I just don't have the basic interest in statistic itself. It's just a means to an end. So I have let those tools slide. As indicated, I had worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service prior to statehood. I worked with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game right after statehood, and then had been at the University of Alaska for 20-some years, but also interacting with the Department of Fish and Game so that I could sense what was happening as far as game management and the attitudes that people both in and out of the state head toward the wildlife resources of Alaska. Alaska has been an extremely interesting and rewarding experience for me. Well, the outdoors has essentially been my life. I can't stand living in an urban setting. That's why I live out here rather than in Fairbanks. I have always just enjoyed nature, be it fish and wildlife or anything else. I've just enjoyed being, by and large, away from a lot of people.
Well, that wraps up today's episode and our three-part series with Sam Harbo, a man I really admired. I hope you enjoyed his stories and benefited from his wisdom. Tune in again next week when we'll share an interview with another great Alaskan outdoorsman.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.